Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the FT Advisor podcast. Today we are discussing the topic of investing in an election year. Elections will dominate the news cycle in the coming months, but is it possible for investors to profit from political outcomes or speculation, or indeed desirable to even try to do so? Joining me today to discuss the topic are Hugh Gimber, market strategist at JP Morgan Asset Management, Sunil Krishnan, head of multi-asset funds at Aviva Investors, and Hiroki Hashimoto, senior fund manager at Royal London Asset Management. Hugh, if we come to you first, for UK-based clients, do overseas elections have any relevance at all when it comes to portfolio construction?
Yes, is the simple answer. I think they do. And the way I would frame this is to say, well, do changes in the economic outlook around the world matter for domestic investors? Of course they do. But that doesn't mean that every election this year is as significant as others. You have some great examples where you have elections in really large countries. Four of the five world's most populous countries go to the polls this year, and yet some of them are going to matter a huge amount for UK-based investors, and others with respect are going to be a lot less meaningful. Take somewhere like Indonesia as an example, a huge country in terms of population, but in a global portfolio, probably making up 0.1 or 0.2% of an international exposure. So yes, they do matter, but they matter only where you see changes to the economic outlook as a result. And point number two, they matter most where you have the largest portfolio allocation.
Thank you. I mean, Hugh, I wasn't expecting anyone to go in heavy on Indonesia's election first, so extra points for that. It probably makes the answers that your peers can give a little bit easier as well. Hiroki, as a senior fund manager at Royal London, are you looking at overseas elections and thinking maybe there's an opportunity there or a threat there or something that you need to be aware of?
Yeah. Thanks, David, and thanks, Hugh, as well. Of course, I agree with Hugh in a sense that some of the elections do matter, especially if they're big like the US when it comes to the impact economy, impact equity and fixed income market. But elections are, of course, what you call unknown knowns, in a sense that you know the date and you know particularly well what the candidate is going to be in terms of presidency, for example. And they're particularly dangerous when it comes to behavioural traps because you can easily go, right, it's going to be unpredictable, let's just forget about it, let's stay in the cash and sidelines until the event, or you go, right, it's been unpredictable outcome, so let's de-risk aggressively. Now, we know that election is important, but it's one of the key factors that goes into the drive of the market, like economic variables and other things like that. So what you need to make sure in portfolio construction is to be diversified, have asset classes that would help you when it comes to unpredictability. For example, if you just have equities and bonds can cause you trouble if you're talking about inflation shocks. And of course, hopefully there's a strategy that we can probably talk about later on about how we can adapt when we see unpredictability. But again, to Hugh's point, what's important is what's going to drive the economic cycle? How can we adapt a portfolio along those ways?
Thank you. And Sunil, for the UK-based clients that you have at Aviva Investors, do they care? Are they saying that to you that they care about elections overseas? Or are you saying to them, there's an election coming, this is how it's relevant to your portfolio?
I think the client experience has been always one of curiosity. People are always interested to know what we think is going on and what the potential implications might be. In terms of the conversations that we're having right now, I guess what's interesting, particularly bearing in mind, as Hugh was saying, we've got a very large number of elections. What's particularly interesting about that is how the range of outcomes that might lead on a, let's say, a kind of medium-term time frame, so not necessarily by the end of the year, but let's say over the next 2 to 3 years, is probably quite wide. But for most of this year, we may be seeing a pickup now, but until now, volatility in markets has been pretty low and pretty calm. And I think maybe in some ways that might do justice to how much change we can expect over the next 6 months, but might underplay how much change we could see in the longer term. So potentially stretching out over the next 2 to 3 years. So I think for us, that's the bit where we are having the most interesting conversations, is to think more broadly about that range of outcomes. And I suppose what follows from that finally is that maybe the best thing to do in regard to the election is do nothing, but then try and observe really hard and think really hard about the outcome and try and look a bit further ahead. I mean, when was the last time that we actually went to a book to try and understand the implications of an election and what it might mean for portfolios.
Thank you. And just to follow up on that point with you, Sunil, as an investor, do you actually prefer, you mentioned there's potentially a wide range of, a wide delta of outcomes and scenarios out there, but as an investor, do you actually prefer politics to be as boring as possible, or rather than viewing them as a source of potential returns amid volatility?
Boredom tends to be pretty good on average for collecting the returns for taking risk. Mm-hmm. So on average, we have tended to see, maybe if we just step back from the pure election year, but in time, times when, for example, you have gridlock in countries where there's, let's say, split government between a president and a legislature, don't tend to be bad times for stock markets, because essentially there's a degree of visibility that there won't be dramatic policy change. And that's quite handy for companies that are trying to plan and investors that are trying to plan. Having said that, I do think that sometimes there will be opportunities mispricing. So, for example, now in some of our portfolios, as I said, we are finding that maybe the range of outcomes is a little underpriced. So maybe we're getting an opportunity to protect portfolios from a broader range of outcomes while staying invested. And I think that's an important way to be able to stay invested for us.
Thank you. Hiroki, how do you feel about that? Are you hoping that, you know, nothing interesting happens in the election cycle and you can just get on with the day job?
Yeah, of course, boring's good as us in a sense that it reduces the macro uncertainty and that tends to reduce long-term volatility. And of course, that, Daniel's point, helps equity investors, which typically do better in those sort of market backdrop. Having said that, of course, we can't choose what backdrop we're going to be in terms of boringness or exciting times. So we need to be prepared in case it's more exciting. In a sense that Warren Buffett used to say, be greedy in what others are fearful. An election result or running up to election day can produce market volatility uncertainty. And if you have a strategy that can take advantage of that, for example, buying into dips, if there are any dips, that might help you, protect in terms of issues you've got around it, but also more sort of adding return to your portfolio and for investors.
Thank you, Hugh. I know that one of the things that you're involved with at JP Morgan is producing this document called Long-Term Capital Market Assumptions. I'm sure are you very happy if politics is so boring you don't have to add some more slides to that deck, right?
I think generally fewer slides is normally a good outcome regardless of what we're talking about. But for me, when you're dealing with an election year, it's less about trying to make really good decisions and it's more about trying to avoid really bad decisions. Because I think when you look at the skills and expertise that investment teams build up, they're about economic forecasting. They're about understanding markets. They're rarely about trying to forecast very unpredictable outcomes at the polls. And you see this in consumer behavior as well. If you take a look at the moment at how US consumers are viewing the health of the economy, there are about 40 to 50% of Democrat voters saying that conditions are good or excellent. For Republicans, that's about 10 or 15%. And that's not just a Democrat versus a Republican divide. If you go back in time and flip when you had Republican leadership in the White House, you see exactly the same kind of gap, just the other way around. So I think it's very easy in election years to get carried away with the emotions and the sort of heart driving the head. But ultimately, the more boring the political outlook, the lower the risk of making a really bad decision.
Thank you. Hiroki, as an investor, do you think UK assets could benefit from a boringness premium? It's not for any of us to comment on election outcomes or probabilities, but that perhaps the range of possible outcomes in the UK might be seen as narrower, or the differences between the alternative parties in the UK could be seen as narrower than in some other countries. Could that then mean that after years where perhaps many overseas investors view the UK politics as very much a negative, that we could now be in a position where they view UK politics as boring and therefore increasing the attractiveness of the asset class?
Good question. Thank you. And yes, when the two leading parties, I suppose, have been fighting on a similar platform, that reduces the unpredictability, as you highlighted, David. And it's also true that UK have been typically unloved in a sense. You can see that through valuation of UK equity markets relative to US or the counterpart, although you could argue some of that is through the sectorial mixes. Now, if there are changes in terms of boring premium coming into market, that'll be quite gradual. It'll be overseas investors gradually getting comfortable with the idea of investing in the UK. So it won't be something you'll see on the day, although you might see a few volatility around it. And that would mean small caps in the UK, commercial property in the UK, those might be assets that benefit. But as a multi-asset investor, one thing we need to be careful of is, in those good scenario, sterling is a big asset class that we invest in. And of course, you'd typically hold overseas assets. So in a counterintuitive way, boring premium would increase sterling value that will depreciate foreign assets. So just have to be careful to make sure that you don't have too much foreign exposures, especially for your lower risk clients.
Thank you. Hugh, from your point of view, it's one of the things that I guess everybody's been pondering for a long time. The UK as a market, as assets, have been volatile quite often, as a result of politics. Are we entering a period where that gets perhaps reversed?
I think that's right. And the way I would consider this question is really through the lens of the bond market. You go back to September 2022, September the 23rd, the day when the mini budget was first announced. It was my birthday, so I remember it very well. And obviously, at the time, you had this huge risk premium being built into UK bond markets. You look forward now to this year, and I think the risks from a bond market perspective primarily lie on the other side of the Atlantic, where if either party were to embark on major tax cut changes or major spending plans at a time where the US is already running a fiscal deficit of 6% of GDP, I think could be quite difficult for the bond market to get its head around. And you compare that to the outlook for the UK or the Eurozone, where, yes, deficits are large, but I think the spending plans are much more contained and much less dependent on the outcome of an election. And therefore, one of the ways to think through this would be that I think the range of outcomes in UK and sovereign European bond markets are smaller, are narrower this year than the potential range of outcomes in the US Treasury market, given that the election in November will all be viewed through that lens of fiscal credibility.
Thank you. By the way, I hope that wasn't the most memorable thing that happened on your birthday that year, right?
I also got COVID on that day, so it was a good day all round.
Yes, okay. Sunil, as a multi-asset guy, and obviously, I mean, presumably most of your clients spend their returns in sterling, is the currency really where you would expect to see any boringness premium or indeed any negative outcome from politics to most impact your clients? And do you think that we are now in a period where clients don't really need to worry too much about a UK election outcome relative to others?
In our portfolios, we have always believed philosophically that it is important to give even investors who are based in the UK access to global investment. So we do have to think a bit about that. And there have been times when sharp movements in either direction, admittedly it's more been towards weakness over the last 5-10 years, do have quite a meaningful impact in terms of how home bias affects the end return of the investor. So we are thinking about that quite a bit. I would say actually, Hugh probably put his finger on the right asset class in terms of where we've maybe seen the biggest impact of political uncertainty in the UK, which is the gilt market. Now, as it happens today, we're actually quite keen on the gilt market on a relative basis. So there are challenges to bond markets globally, but they still do an important diversification job. And we're preferring to take a bit more of that exposure through the gilt market than, say, the US Treasury market or Japan, etc. So I suppose the question is, when you think about why that is that jeopardized or strengthened by the election? I think it is strengthened to the extent that there are challenges for growth in the UK. And monetary policy is over time going to have to respond. I would say you probably still have a bit of a, I don't know what the opposite of boringness premium is, maybe interest discount or, you know, excitement discount in the UK, where investors are concerned that it will still take a bit longer for inflation to come down than in other countries. I think given how economic activity is progressing in the UK, we're seeing a bit of a slowdown in the housing market and labour market. Well, I think we're more relaxed about that. And then the question is, how does the politics change that? And the truth is, in fiscal terms, in terms of how much is going to be saved or spent, in the near term of the next parliament, you wouldn't expect that there's going to be a lot of variation. And in fact, the current government has done some rather smart manoeuvring in terms of identifying areas where a new government could raise funds and bringing those into promises now. So that's actually in some ways kind of forcing the parties closer together. At the same time, and this is also, I think, part of the reason for the discount that the UK assets have faced, I don't think is just about political uncertainty. I think some of it is also about structural challenges to public services, to growth, that any new government is going to have to face. And I think that is likely to reintroduce a bit of news and noise to politics in the second half of the next parliament anyway. And that's not really a party political point. I think either party will have to deal with that. So for now, we do see a benefit. In normal times, calm times, monetary policy does its work. But I think we will need to keep watching that quite closely over the next 2 to 3 years.
Thank you, Sunil. And Hugh, to bring a few of those points together, in the world we live in today, every single day, all of our inboxes have commentary or points or debates around interest rates, and not just interest rates actually moving, but people speculating on the speculation about interest rates moving. In that world, politicians don't set monetary policy. They obviously don't influence monetary policy. But are we in a world where actually the monetary policy actions of various central banks will be more consequential for investors over the coming years than will the fiscal policy element, which obviously is what politicians can impact?
So I completely agree with you that monetary policy is where the excitement is today. It's what's filling the column inches. It's filling lots of our discussions, I'm sure, all around the table. But I do think that we're also learning fiscal policy, although it's not as often in the headlines, is actually much more potent than monetary policy. And I think the last decade was a really good example of this, where you had central bankers trying everything they could to try and get inflation back to 2% and finding it incredibly difficult. And I think fiscal policy has a lot of the answer behind that. You look at the way that government investment in the UK slumped during the 2010s. You look at public sector wage growth, for example, in negative real terms for many years over that decade. And therefore, you think back to that time, and no wonder the Bank of England was finding it pretty hard to generate much inflation, because the government really had its foot on the brake in terms of the economy. And you roll forward now to the last couple of years, where central banks have been fighting hard to try and tame inflation. But at a time where you've had a lot of fiscal spending coming from governments, they've also found it really hard. So I agree with some of the question, in that over the next few months, in the very short term, markets are going to be very sensitive to how the central banks behave. But I think if you're lining up, you know, which is a more powerful force for the economy, monetary or fiscal policy, in my view, we've certainly seen a lot in recent times to suggest that fiscal policy is the more important factor.
Thank you. Hiroki, from your point of view, when you're putting portfolios together, are you paying more attention to what the Bank of England or their central banks are available are saying than what a politician of any flavour is saying?
Thank you. I mean, to Hugh's point, monetary policy is more exciting, I suppose, to investors and market commentators, but partly because it happens, what, 8 times a year? Mm-hmm. And it's only one blunt tool out of now, which is, do you cut rates or not? Whereas when it comes to fiscal policy, there's hundreds of different levers and it can happen gradually over time. And it's difficult to see, at least imagine, what the immediate impact will be at that point of announcement. Hence, but they are both important. To Sander's point earlier, fiscal policy differential did impact perhaps maybe US outperformance over the last couple of years ahead of the European counterparts. And so what we're saying to our investors is make sure you know what sort of policy would impact business cycle and evolve as it develops, particularly in an environment where we think inflation backdrop probably changed compared to the last 2 or 3 decades. And you could argue, right, yeah, inflation's coming down now, so we might go back to low and stable environment, but then especially with excitement around AI helping productivity, etc. But if you look at other factors like demographic changes, where working population is, I suppose, aging, they're leaving the workforce, and obviously structurally labour market's now tighter, and that having at the same time with environment where, I suppose, we're tackling climate change, so that's forcing the supplies in traditional oil and gas industry to come down, just as geopolitical risk arising. And all of those means inflation backdrop is important. And that means it's going to be sensitive in terms of one market that Hugh and Sano talked about, in terms of direction of fiscal policy, the fiscal sustainability, as well as monetary policy. So it's much of a tight rope between sort of understanding what is important. They're both important. You just have to watch on it. And again, evolve your asset allocation as it becomes more clear.
Thank you. Sunil, from your point of view, is it the case that monetary policy, I mean, the central banks appear to be moving, if not in lockstep, I mean, they're all at least walking in the same direction. Whereas one potential consequence of the election cycle is that we could have major economies with moving fiscal policy in different directions. But does the second one matter much?
I think Hiroki makes a good point about the neatness of monetary policy as far as analysts, economists, investors are concerned versus the messiness of fiscal policy. And the reality is understanding the consequences of fiscal policy and indeed its interaction with monetary policy is complicated. And it doesn't have a neat calendar. It doesn't have a neat distribution of outcomes. No one produces a dot plot for where the different members of parliament are going to kind of place their votes and so on. Or indeed how other countries will react. But I think all of those things and that messiness, I think, really reflects the situation that we're in, where the biggest challenges that we're facing, Hiroki's referred to it too, but even if you just take climate on the one hand and industrial policy / international rivalry in a geopolitical context, just those two issues, monetary policy has relatively little to say about those. So I think what you have now is governments that are trying to come up with their responses to those challenges. And without going back to those old slightly conspiratorial economic theories that say, well, the government tells the central bank what to do, it's almost as though the central bank today is picking up the pieces of what the government decides to do. Now, governments haven't really gone all in on their policies, which is why, as you say, monetary policy is largely running in lockstep. But I think to the extent you see divergences over the next few years, I think our base case is that's going to be much easier to trace the causes of from fiscal policy and the choices made by governments. Maybe not just fiscal, may also be foreign policy, industrial policy. But that's going to drive the divergences. And again, going back to the neatness point, what's so neat about the cash interest rate is it directly drives what's happening in the yield curves of the bond market. But if that in turn is being driven by these messy factors, we are just going to have to watch them really closely. And I would say, if anything, we've almost tried to force ourselves to shift our focus and our economist focus away from the nice, neat monetary policy of central bank watching towards some of the bigger, more thematic issues.
Thank you for that. And so, Neil, could the fiscal statements rather than actions, because one thing, maybe the only thing we know in an election year is that politicians are going to say a lot of things to get attention. Could the things that they say potentially impact inflation expectations for the economies about which they are speaking, and therefore that impact not just markets and volatility, but actually also impact monetary policy direction?
Well, I suppose if we look at the US as an example, where perhaps the economy seems to be running the hottest. And one of the interesting comments that was made about Donald Trump's first term, for example, is that he was to be taken seriously, but not literally. And I think what that means is it will be quite difficult to immediately respond to a pronouncement that's made on the campaign trail, because not only do people not know who's going to win, but also they don't know exactly what's going to be enacted. And actually, this brings us back full circle to the risks of being too preemptive or reactive to the short-term election day outcome. Because something that was very clear to British investors in 2016 with Brexit, but also I think in terms of the outcomes of the US election that followed that year, is that even if you know the outcome, figuring out exactly what the economic and market response and consequences will be is not straightforward. So I think that's also something that needs to be borne in mind. So I think, again, probably hindsight will show that the right thing to do will be take a breath, understand who's won, understand what they actually intend to do. Perhaps importantly, who do they surround themselves with and what's their agenda? Because often they're more important in driving specific policy. Then maybe read a book, then maybe read another book, then start making some decisions. But that kind of time lag, I think, is really important to avoid overreaction in what we're trying to do.
Thank you. Hugh, you mentioned the impact that the mini budget fiscal event had, which it was rapid and quite brutal in terms of its impact on fiscal policy. But this, I guess, would be a more subtle potential impact. But do you expect to see volatility based on politician X makes statement and market reacts?
So, yes and no. I want to pick up on one thing that Sunil mentioned around what politicians say they will do and what they ultimately can do. You go back over the last four US election cycles, and the winning candidate in total has made over 700 campaign promises. Now, less than
half of those... That's a wonderful stat, by the way.
Yeah, well that's half of the wonderful stat. So 700 campaign promises, less than half of those have made it into law. And that's partly because the realities of governing become a lot clearer after a victory, but also it depends on, in the US, the composition of Congress. So one thing we haven't spoken about so far today is that it's not just who wins the White House in November, it's who controls the Senate, who controls the House, which is going to have a big influence on what the eventual president can ultimately do in terms of enacting their agenda. And it comes back to that first point that I think we've all made around the table. This is about trying to not overreact, trying not to build a portfolio based on an assumed outcome, because ultimately, none of us know who's going to win various elections this year. And most importantly, to Sunil's point, then none of us know what they're actually going to be able to do and what their market reaction is going to be. So this is a year, I think, to do a lot of thinking, a lot of homework, but again, echoing what we've heard just now, to be taking a breath before making decisions, because it's much more likely people are going to make bad decisions in a big election year than to make very good ones.
Thank you. Hiroki, do you think about, you know, if a politician makes a statement, could it impact whatever about the big picture stuff like the bond market impact, which both you and Sunil have referenced, but the impact on individual parts of the equity market, individual equity sectors, for example, is that something that investors should pay attention to, or again view those as second order effects?
Good question. So when it comes to, again, politicians' promises or campaigns, as both Sano and Hu highlighted, some of them make it through to the end, some of them don't. And so you just have to take it with on a day-to-day basis, what's affecting the economy, what is more noise. You just have to kind of go through that process. And in order to help you do that, I guess, to both our panelists' points, do the homework. So understand how the economic cycles work, what drives the market. And I mean, we call it in our framework investment clock, where you can sort of see how the impact is through over time. So, for example, when you're in a time where inflation is perhaps rising even from low levels, that can have an impact based on what the growth is doing. So, actually, high inflation might be okay if economic situation is improving and it improves the corporate profit. But having said that, same time, like we experienced 2 years ago, if we're worried about recession at the same time, then of course that has an impact, and that potentially have impact on equities and bonds too. So what I'm trying to say here is actually trying to respond immediately. What sector is going to do, what asset class is going to do, is going to be more visible over time as those economic cycles develop. And you can see, for example, which sectors and businesses will do better. Just have to watch it on a daily basis and adopt your portfolios accordingly. But in a way that's set up and researched previously rather than responding in a behavioural way.
Thank you for that, Hiroki. And thank you to Hugh Gimber, market strategist at JP Morgan Asset Management, Sunil Krishnan, head of multi-asset funds at Aviva Investors, and to Hiroki Hashimoto, senior fund manager at Royal London Asset Management. And thank you all for listening. Please do remember to tune in to future editions of the FT Advisor podcast. Thank you.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout.
36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.